This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Because Homeland is filming in Charlotte, we have some high-profile people wandering our streets, among them our guest this hour. He's one of the stars of that critically acclaimed, multiple Emmy-winning series on Showtime, but he is also a star of movies, Broadway, and the concert stage, who will be performing his one-man show, Dress Casual, at the Belk Theater this Sunday, October 28th. I'll let him introduce himself.
Hello. My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
Mandy Patinkin, welcome to Charlotte. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here. I listen to you every day.
Thank you. God, that's it's almost frightening to hear that from somebody like you.
Oh, no, I love it. As a matter of fact, I can't find another radio station on my car. You're it.
Give and give generously, man.
I mean it. I'm not whistling Dixie. I love your station here. It's really, it's the lifeblood of driving.
Thank you very much. That is one famous line, that hello, my name is Inigo Montoya, prepare to die. Yeah. Of all the work that you have done, what's it going to be like to be remembered for that line? What is it like to be remembered?
Oh, my God. Are you kidding? It's thrilling to be remembered for anything, and let alone something that seems to have crossed generations and makes kids of all ages happy. I can't get over it. Every single day somebody says something to me about it or an interview, and I'm not kidding. I can't get over that I'm the guy who got to do it, that I'm the guy who got to be in the movie, and it became this huge thing for people. I don't know what it's like. I don't know how to answer it. It's surreal. I'm just so grateful for it. It was a job. We worked our butts off, had a great time. One of those jobs you felt like I should be paying you. It was hilarious being with Billy Crystal and Rob Reiner and this wonderful group of people and Bill Goldman's script. And then it opened up and nobody came to see it. I remember I was in L.A. doing something. I was so excited. I went to a theater. There were two people in there. And then over the years, all of a sudden, it became this cult classic at colleges and started to grow. And before I know it, I was at the 25th anniversary at the New York Film Festival last week. And we were all there, everyone who was alive, except for Andre and Peter Falk and Peter Cook, God mm-hmm. rest their souls. And it was an amazing experience, and Bill Goldman was so moved.
You did your own sword fighting in that, and I'm told that you had never done that before.
I had done it a bit with the New York Shakespeare Festival, doing, I think, Henry IV. I did a sword fight with Johnny Goodman in the park at the Delacorte Theater, and I studied it at the Juilliard School, but not like when I had to do this movie, because when I opened the script, the very first thing it said was, it said, Inigo Montoya, the world's greatest sword fighter. So I knew what I had to do, and I contacted an extraordinary gentleman named Henry Hartunian, who was the Yale Olympic fencing coach. And he met with me for 2 months at 890 Broadway, which was Michael Bennett's studios. And I trained there for two solid months, learning it from the ground up. It's sort of like ballet, the positions, et cetera. And I trained there for 2 months from the ground up, and then we began training only with my left hand because I'm a righty. And then I actually got far better with my left than my right. And then we went over to England, and we trained with Bob Anderson for another 4 months. And
do you always fight with your left hand when you're a sword fighter?
No, you fight with your dominant hand.
Why then? Why did you train with your left hand?
Because in the film, I begin fighting with my left hand. And then I tell him I'm not left-handed as I'm beginning to lose, and I switch hands, and then he tells me he's not left-handed. And it was actually one of the most thrilling moments, and he switches hands. It was one of the most thrilling moments of the whole filming process because we did all the fighting ourselves.
Right.
And Rob arranged it so we did the fight sequences at the end of the film. And when the left-handed thing started going up the steps that we'd choreographed for about 5-6 months in total, it didn't work for the camera angle for whatever reason. I can't remember what the reason, but we had to re-choreograph this several, moment beat within 20 minutes. And Carrie and I and Bob Anderson set about this job, and in 20 minutes we re-choreographed this whole segment, going up the steps, switching hands. And at that moment we realized, my God, we'd actually learned a skill. we actually became sword fighters, and we could do that on the dime like that.
And people think, well, it's in the movies, so that it's all fake. No one can get hurt doing this. But these are swords, right?
Yes, they are. They are indeed swords. The hilt themselves are quite heavy.
Yeah.
So when we fought, we had carbon blades, which lessened the weight by about 60%. And then other times we had real blades in the swords. And I have these swords to this day. And I gave them to both of my sons on my 40th birthday, which I'm overwhelmed to say was almost 20 years ago.
Please don't go there. You mentioned that you went to Juilliard. How did you get to Juilliard?
I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and then it was time to go to college. So I made a very simple decision. I chose the University of Kansas because a girl that I was interested in went there. And by the time I got there, she was a year ahead of me. She'd fallen in love with someone else. So I lost on that front, and then I got involved in doing some plays, and the professor said to me, we think you should go to a professional school. I think that would be better for you. And also the chancellor called me into his office, and he said, listen, Mandy, I just saw you in this play, and we're all very proud of the work you're doing in the play, just as we're proud of some very famous football player that came from KU at that time. I forget his name, but he said, but you both have a common problem. And as chancellor of the university, I have to address this. Neither of you want to seem to go to any classes. And you need to find a way to balance this a little more and go to some of these courses. I said, well, it's difficult for me because I'm in the theater all the time and I'm doing these plays. I'm working on this. And I said, I understand your point of view. He said, please. So try to find a way. And then at that point, one of my professors said, why don't you go to a professional school? So I never thought I'd get in. I applied to the Goodman School of Drama in Chicago, at where I'm from, and the Juilliard School of Drama in New York. And I chose the one furthest away from home. And I went there, and I wanted to learn to be a classical actor, and that's what I trained for.
Is that where it began, at the University of Kansas, or had you been acting before you went to college?
I had started acting on the south side of Chicago at the Jewish Community Center, the Young Men's Jewish Council Community Center, which actually saved my life. I hated school. It had nothing that I was interested in. I made the mistake occasionally early on in each class. I did okay on a test. So I screwed myself because my parents and the teacher said, it's not like you can't do it. You don't seem to want to. And I didn't want to. I wasn't interested. I also learned later on that I needed to learn out loud when we tested our children for possible learning disabilities. And one day, this very skillful woman said, I'd been working on a script for months. Silently, and she said one of the things about our children was they need to do their homework out loud. And everything she was saying, I was thinking she was talking about me. And I said, well, I've been learning this script, and I've been having trouble learning it, and I never have trouble learning Shakespeare, which I always do out loud. I never have trouble learning a song, which I do out loud. She said, have you tried learning your script out loud? I said, no. She said, try it. Well, in 2 days, I had it. And had someone told me as a child that I should say my lessons out loud, I needed the visual and the audio at the same time, I would have had a much easier time. So as a kid, when you don't know any of the answers and you can't remember everything, you feel like, you know, to hell with this. I want to get out of here.
Yeah.
And my mom said, why don't you go over to the youth center? They're doing some plays over there. And I said, that's not for me. Forget it. You don't know me at all. And then I was in fifth period lunch one day, and we were playing penny pool on the lunch table, and a guy says, we're doing some plays over at the youth center. We're short a couple of guys. I said, yeah, it sounds cool. So I go over there, and I ended up in a show called Anything Goes, playing a sailor, and what now we refer to as an Asian, but then we said a Chinaman.
Uh-huh.
And that was the beginning of my career.
So was Anything Goes in Chicago your first moment on a stage?
No. I really survived because from the age of seven, I remember from 7 or 6 years old on, I was in the boys' choir in synagogue at the Rodfay Zedek Synagogue in Hyde Park Boulevard, which is right around the corner from where Barack Obama lives now. And I sang in the temple choir every Friday night and every Saturday in the boys' choir.
That's what I was getting to. I wanted to know when the singing began,
yeah.
When that voice began to happen.
Yeah, it was in the boys' choir and in the family choir in the synagogue, and I heard all the old men davening, and my Uncle Harold Dre had this gorgeous, gorgeous voice, and I loved it, and I would imitate these guys. And then they would ask me to sing solos, and I was a boy soprano. And that was music for me, was the synagogue.
In many ways, and I mean this with all respect and admiration, you're still a boy soprano. You have this, to hear your speaking voice and then to hear your singing voice, it's like two different people almost.
It is a strange thing. While I was living in Hyde Park in high school, I was in the first graduating class of the Kenwood High School, and I was in chorus, once again, because I didn't enjoy most of the other classes, but I loved chorus. And Lena McClin was our choral teacher, and she asked me to sing something one day. And I sang it in my high voice, and she said, "Child," and I said, "Miss McClin, I'm sorry, I know I should have sung out louder." She says, "No, child." She says, I thought I was going to get yelled at for not belting out the solo. She says, I sang in my high voice, and she said, "Anyone ever tell you that you can't use that voice, you tell them, come talk to Lena." And that woman gave me my courage to use whatever voice I chose for the rest of my life, my choral teacher. And then I had this ability to do that, which was this soprano voice that sort of lived, sort of lasted for the rest of my life. And she gave me the courage to not be afraid to use it.
Just a Broadway baby, walking off my tired feet, pounding 42nd Street to be in a show.
Almost everybody who goes and becomes a professional in theater, at least, gets singing lessons or has a coach who helps them develop their voice. And your voice, you know, I hate using the words "so unique," because unique does not need a modifier, but it is so unique that at some point, I'm curious if somebody said to you, "No, you can't do that. You have to develop this Broadway voice. That's not a Broadway voice. What is that voice? You've got to change that." No one ever did that to you?
Yeah, they did. My mom, bless her, wanted me to, she saw that I had this ability to sing, and I got involved in the plays, and she thought, well, you should study a little. So she took me out to Rosendale, Chicago, and this woman was starting to give me these lessons, and I hated it, and I didn't want to do it, and I refused to go. I didn't want to be an opera singer, and I said, forget about it, and leave me alone. And then I went about my business, and while I was doing a play called The Shadow Box in 1975 or so, Geraldine Fitzgerald was in the production. And we opened the play in New Haven, and then we brought it to Broadway. And I guess I was humming backstage or during rehearsal, and she gave me for my birthday present a voice lesson with Andy Thomas Anselmo, who was her vocal teacher. I went to this guy, and he heard me sing, and he said, "How do you do that?" I said, "I don't know. It's just how I sang. I sang this way in the choir." And he taught me, he made me aware of what I was doing, which I just wasn't aware of, and he taught me how to do it and not hurt myself, because he said, "You're going to be a singer." I said, "No, I'm trying to be a classical actor." He said, "Sorry, you're going to be a singer. And this is what you're doing, and I want you to be aware of what you're doing so that when you're tired or not feeling well, you don't hurt yourself." So he taught me that.
And a great big Broadway show.
Mandy Patinkin is our guest. We're going to take a break. Come right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and our guest this hour is Mandy Patinkin, star of Homeland and, of course, Broadway. Here's a bit of his performance in The Secret Garden.
Yes, child, come in.
Thank you, sir.
Are you well? Do they take good care of you?
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Is there anything you need? Would you like some toys or books? Or dolls, perhaps?
Might I?
Speak up, child.
Might I have a bit of earth, sir?
A bit of earth?
To plant seeds in. Yes, sir. A garden.
Do you care about gardens so much, then?
I didn't know about them in India. I was always ill and tired, and it was too hot. I sometimes played at
She wants a little
beds,
bit of earth.
Sticking things in the sun.
She'll plant some seeds. the seeds will grow, the flowers bloom, but is there bounty what she needs? How can she chance to love a little bit of earth? Does she not know? The earth is old and doesn't care if one small girl wants things to grow. She needs a friend.
Dress Casual is the name of Mandy Patinkin's one-man show, which is this Sunday night at the Belk Theater, which, by the way, I saw the last time you performed it here. And when you say casual, it's casual, or at least it appears casual.
Yeah,
almost like you're making it up on the spot.
Yeah, I try to make it that way. It's also to relax myself and the audience. I like it to feel like we're at home in my studio.
That's exactly what it looks like. That's exactly what it feels like. And it's so unusual because most stuff is rehearsed to a fare thee well, and everything happens at the right time, and the light cues and the sound cues, blah, blah, blah. This is different and perfect for a Sunday night.
Yeah, thanks. Well, please come, because I love doing it, and it's a way that I get to get away from whatever it is in the world I want to get away from for a few minutes. There's nothing I love more than singing the words of these geniuses who wrote these wishes for themselves and the world. In many cases, some of these guys, like Oscar Hammerstein, Irving Berlin, Stephen Sondheim, couldn't live the wishes for themselves, but they left them for the rest of us to hear. And interesting thing is, in most cases, I didn't grow up with the majority of this music. I started singing it toward the end of high school, you know, and started to be introduced to it in high school, actually, not the end of high school. But it wasn't something I heard growing up as a little kid. But it spoke to me. I love these ideas that these guys wrote about. And the comfort of the concert to me is to sit in a room with other people who are also listening along with me. I just happen to be the mailman.
Mm. You mentioned Oscar Hammerstein, and there's a song that you sing. I'm not sure you're singing it Sunday night, but it's from Rodgers and Hammerstein's Carousel, called If I Loved You, and it's one of my favorite songs in theater, and it was originally sung by John Raitt, and since then has been sung by these big boffo baritones with great power and force. And you sing this as lightly, I think, as humanly possible.
Oh, you can't hear a sound, not the turn of a leaf, nor the fall of a wave hitting the sand. The tide's creeping up on the beach like a thief, afraid to be caught stealing the land. There's a hell of a lot.
It's an interesting choice. It actually, you would think, goes against the character, because this character's this macho guy. And yet it doesn't. It gives it a quality that if Julie Jordan were on stage with you, it would make her fall in love with you.
Hmm. Well, I get to do it when I do the Patty Mandy show. We have this whole section, this sort of a mini carousel that we do. We do the entire bench scene together.
If I loved you, time and again I would try to say, all I'd want you to know. If I loved you, words wouldn't come in an easy way. Round in circles I'd go.
It's interesting you bring up that song, because I think actually at some point during the Patty Mandy thing, I used to do it the way you're talking about. And then because of the scene itself, when once you put it in the scene in its context, it I think it just became a little different. But I don't pay that close attention to it, so it might be similar to what you're doing.
You'd leave me. Off you would go in the mist of day. Never, never to know I loved you. If I
I'm not sure I do it the same way anymore. You know, I've been doing this now for 24, 25 years, and it's interesting. You know, gravity has its own effects on all of us. And
so you're a step lower?
I would think there are some changes that take place.
Longing to tell you, but afraid and shy, I'd let my golden chances
version that we're listening to.
Yeah.
You do go from this incredible gossamer lightness to this big, let's do Broadway without a microphone sound all of a sudden. Which part of that equation comes more naturally to you or is easier for you, or is there any difference?
No, there's no difference. I just sing what I feel, and I say it. It's just words to me, and I say them in the range that feels appropriate. Oftentimes when I'm working with Paul Ford, my piano player, and we're arranging something, I speak in images, and I'll say, let's just do it like as to a child in the crib, as though we're rocking the baby to sleep. But can you play something that just doesn't frighten the baby? Or can you play the opposite? Can you play it as though there's a carousel in the sky in the background, and it's going around and around and getting further and further away like a film image, and I'm reaching for it? So we just speak in images. And when you bring that up, it reminds me of how the way we work, Paul Ford and I together, how it birthed itself, how we approach a song, which I really hadn't thought of for years and years. And then someone was interviewing me one day, and it just popped into my head, and I realized how I work on music, because I don't read music. I can't read a note of music. And like I said earlier, I just know it from singing in the choir at Temple. But all of a sudden, I realized how we assemble and arrange a song, because to me, as I said, it's just words. And I remembered at the Juilliard School of Drama on the third floor, which is sort of a long rectangle, but the drama department was at this corner of the L, and at the other corner of the L of the rectangle was the orchestra room. And Leonard Bernstein would often be in there conducting the Juilliard Orchestra. And during our breaks, we were allowed to go sit down in our sweat clothes and lay on the floor and take a nap while he would, you know, work the orchestra. And I'll never forget one day, I was in there and I was almost asleep, and I heard him stop the orchestra and say, "No, no, no, stop." He said, it's a storm. It's a lightning storm. It's a raging, raging storm. And the gazelle are starting to fly, and the birds are screaming, and the lightning strikes the tree, and this animal does that, and this animal does that, and this is what's happening. Now play it. And they played, and it was another world that took place in that room. He didn't use a single musical phrase to explain anything. He spoke in images, and at that moment I realized that that's where I got it from. I just stole it from him from that day.
Now, you don't read music, but you have worked with Stephen Sondheim.
Yes, sir.
And I know that Stephen Sondheim, who I think is the greatest living American composer and possibly the greatest American composer working in the theater ever.
I agree.
Is a stickler for having people sing it, and he's notorious for writing intensely difficult rhythms and pitch combinations. Melodies that are not they don't repeat each other a lot of times. One time when you do a melody for him, that note's a D, and the next time it's an E flat. You don't know why, but that's what he hears in his head, and that's what he wants you to reproduce. If you can't read it off the page, how do you learn it?
Well, Paul Ford plays it for me, and I hear it once or twice, and I know it. I don't know why. I don't know how. I made up my own system of writing music, which are little arrows that go up or down. And if it like goes up a little higher than normal, I put two arrows. If it goes up way high, I make the arrows darker, and I make squiggly lines. So I essentially created my own way of writing music, you know, if I have to make notations. But I, like Stephen, am also a stickler for it being accurate, as is Paul Ford, my piano player, and Steve Sondheim's piano player as well. And Paul makes sure whatever song I'm learning, whether it's Sondheim or whoever it is, that we do a one-finger learning tape first. And I get that, and I drill it, and sometimes it's more than a couple times until I have it, and I do not move forward until I have that in me. Then if I choose later on down the line to improvise or change something, it's only after I've absolutely known how it was originally constructed.
Wow. It would seem to me that you've been doing this long enough that you might have time to learn to read music. Do you fight it now because you don't really, you have your own system? Why learn something new?
I wanted to, and I was doing a play called, it was based on Rhinoceros. I forget the name of the play. We were doing it at the Chichester Festival in England, and Sir Peter Hall was directing it, and I was in it with Jose Farrar, the great actor Jose Farrar. And Jose and I went over, we had to sing, and Paul Ford met with both of us, and we made learning tapes, and he had a tape recorder, too. This was before they had digital recorders, and cassette recorders. And on the way home to Jose's house, he said to me, what do you think we did before these tape recorders? I said, I don't know. What did you do? We learned music. We read music, which I'm going to make sure you learn how to do. So in England, Jose would try to teach me to read music every day. And I got pretty far. And Paul Ford says to me at this point, he feels that I do know how to read music because I look at it and I can, you know, you sort of watch it. It's like looking at the hills and judging the topography of the land as the notes change and move up and down. But I would never say publicly that I could read music.
So are you an actor in your mind? Are you an actor who sings? Or a singer who acts?
I am an actor who speaks words written by gifted people, and on some occasions those words happen to be written on musical notes.
You made your Broadway debut in 1980 in Evita, working with another composer who has eclipsed almost everybody who came before him, Andrew Lloyd Webber. What was that experience like? Young guy, 1980, Broadway debut, new show. Andrew Lloyd Webber.
It was a great experience. I was doing a play down at the Public Theater at the time called Leave It to Beaver Is Dead, written by Des McAnuff, who later became the director of Jersey Boys and many other things.
Right.
And Patty and I were cast in Evita. We rehearsed for 3 weeks in New York, and then we took it out to Los Angeles to open it at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. It was just, you know, hard work. I learned the music instantly. Hal Prince, who directed it, Hal didn't want us to come into the first day of rehearsal without knowing the material. And we just did it. And I remember being shocked. It wasn't hard. It was one of the easiest things I'd ever done, compared to Shakespeare, compared to doing the play we had just done, Leave It to Beaver Is Dead, at the Public Theater, which to me, I thought this was incredible theater. You know, every critic killed Leave It to Beaver Is Dead across the boards, and there were lines around the block at the Public because it became a cult thing overnight. And then we opened this thing called Evita in Los Angeles, and the joint. And, you know, the Dorothy Chandler, I don't know how many seats there are there, but the people, we go out for the curtain call, and they just leap to their feet screaming. And I remember thinking in my head, if you like this, you should come to the Public Theater and see what we're doing there. We're really doing some interesting stuff there. And, you know, so that wave of commercial love that people had for this product versus the more avant-garde stuff I'd been doing downtown threw me. I was confused.
I flying adored, so young, instant queen, a rich, beautiful thing, of all the talents, cross between fantasy of the bedroom and the same.
You worked with Patti LuPone in Evita and in Sunday in the Park with George with Bernadette Peters.
Yes.
Another queen of musical theater.
And Patti. Just a glorious human being as well.
Taught me how to sing,
Notice every tree.
Understand the light.
Concentrate.
I want to explore the light. I want to know how to get through to something new, something of my own. Move on.
When you look back on your career, which we'll talk about in more broad strokes, I think, as we go through this conversation, does it amaze you who you've worked with and what you've done?
It is overwhelming. It really is overwhelming. I'm going to be 60 years old. I've almost finished living my 60th year. On November 30th this year, I will have completed 60 years of living. And I don't often think about it until I'm speaking in front of a group of students who ask me questions. And I inevitably, I'm not a teacher, I don't have a plan, but they ask me this, and then this comes out of my mouth, and that story comes out, and this example comes out, and that. And all of a sudden, by the time the 2.5-3 hours are over, and I've said these tales, and I've talked about different people and experiences that I've had to share, you know, things that I was trying to give that I had learned along the road, I pause. I say to myself, oh my God, you actually are one of these people who knew all of these people. You know, when you were a kid and you listened to people tell all these stories, you've become one of these people who met all these different people along the road. And, you know, you don't plan it. You don't know what's going to happen the next 5 seconds from now. But when you start to reflect or tell stories to someone like yourself or to a group of students, you realize that you have had more of a life than you ever imagined.
Give us more to see.
Mandy Patinkin is our guest. His one-man show, Dress Casual, at the Belk Theater, plays Sunday night. We'll have more in a second. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we are spending the hour with Mandy Patinkin. He'll be performing one of his one-man shows, Dress Casual, at the Belk Theater on Sunday night. You can get tickets at 704-372-1000 or at blumenthalarts.org. But you may have seen him around town for months because he is also one of the stars of Homeland, which is shot primarily here in Charlotte. And I think we should spend some time talking about that. You're one of the few people, although there seem to be more and more people from Broadway, who are making their way into movies and television, but you're one of the few people from your generation, I believe, who have been successfully able to do movies and TV and theater and concert performances. How did that happen for you?
All by accident. And I swear to you, I told you, I set out, I sang in the choir at Temple, so you didn't need to learn how to do that. Everybody did that in the synagogue. So I wanted to learn to be an actor. So I went to Juilliard to train as a classical actor. That was my goal. By accident, my agent says, go downtown while I'm doing Leave It to Beaver is Dead at the Public Theater and audition for this show called Evita. I said, no, I'm busy. I can't go. He said, what are you talking about? I said, I'm in a 5-character play. I'm not just leaving rehearsal. We had a big argument. He's talked to me about priorities, and he won. I went down there, was furious that I had to pay like $18 for the white album of Evita to go listen to it. I end up getting this show, finding out Patti LuPone's in it, was ecstatic because I'd seen her, and I knew she was a great actress. That then leads somewhere down the road to being asked to do films. While I was doing Evita, Milos Forman asked me to do Ragtime, and I ended up in films, which was sort of a dream of mine always, and then that led to several other films. And at some point, Joe Dash from CBS Masterworks Records said, would you come and do an album and play Cable on an album of South Pacific with Kiri Takanawa and Sarah Vaughan and Jose Carreras? And I said, sure. I go to London. While I'm over there, he says, listen, and it was the day the Challenger blew up. I'll never forget because we were going to all have dinner together, and I never got my chance to meet Sarah Vaughan.
January 28th.
Yes. And so I missed meeting Sarah Vaughan because that was the day and because we all recorded separately. I then down the road record this album, and I always dreamed of recording a record album. But somebody said to me, you can't do that. She was a big producer of people who sang, and I won't say who were the people because it'll give it away. But she said, you can't do that. You have to go a certain way. You have to be on the road, do your concerts, write your songs. Then years later, if you're lucky, you get to make a record, and that's how it works. Well, by accident, he says, would I make a record? Well, I put it off for a year because I dreamed about making a record, and if I made it and it didn't go well, then my dream would be killed, so I thought, so don't ever make it. And then I worked with Paul Ford. We worked for a year together. We made the record, and it did well. And then what do we do with the record? And the Schuberts said, well, why don't you do it on Broadway? You're from Broadway. Get a 50-piece orchestra, spend all this money. And I said, I can't handle that. That makes me turn nervous. I don't know what I'm doing. Can't I do it with an upright piano like I do it at home at my studio? And Joseph Papp, the glorious producer of the New York Shakespeare Festival, Free Shakespeare in Central Park, and produced the Chorus Line and signed the ketubah at my wedding, it was like my father, came over for a Shabbos dinner, and he said, well, you didn't ask me. He said, I want you to do Leontes and the Winter's Tale. James Lapine is directing it, and Chris Reeve was in it, and Alfre Woodard and Diana Vannora. He said, and you can try your little music thing on Monday nights. You got 6 Monday nights. So the first Monday night came, and I went out on the stage of Winter's Tale at the Public Theater and the Ansbacher Theater. Paul Ford was packed away underneath the riser. We did the first concert, and Joe came up to me afterwards, put his hands on my shoulder, looked at me in the mirror, and said, well, I guess you like doing that. And then he said to me, you will always need to do these two things together. What do you mean? I said, you will need to work on the classics and your music together to feel fulfilled. And he was right. And so then that got birthed. And the concert slowly started taking over my life. And I remember during that time I birthed that concert and did The Winter's Tale, I was running out of dough because they were downtown for no money for over a year or two. So I called Warren Beatty, who was a good friend, and I called other friends, and I said, listen, I need some dough to pay the rent. Can you, I'll serve a drink in a film, anything, just to make the rent. And he wrote me the part of 88 Keys, and Dick Tracy, and Sondheim wrote me a song, What Can You Lose, that I did with Madonna. And these are all accidents. And that's, I think, when I talk to people, I say, reach, look for the accidents in your life. They're the gold.
You talk about being fulfilled by doing the classics and also by involving yourself in singing and music. You are also somebody, and this is really interesting to me, who has been able to be successful artistically and commercially. And somebody who has been able to maintain artistic integrity in the commercial world. You walked away from Criminal Minds on CBS. You did that because I'm told it was tampering with your soul, destructive to your soul and personality, you said, because of the subject matter of the show. You walked away, happily, on both parts, from Chicago Hope, a very successful TV show in which they let you sing. You were a singing doctor.
Yes.
But you walked away from that. People don't walk away from television shows. They don't do that.
Yeah.
If they ever want to work again, and here you are working again. How have you been able to do that?
Listen, I just followed my heart. I didn't have a plan. There were all different circumstances. Chicago Hope, I wasn't with my family, and we were working all these hours. My kids were little, and I just saw time flying by. And I had a wonderful, glorious relationship with David Kelly, and we still do to this day. And I didn't ever totally walk away. I walked away from the permanent part of the job, and I came back as a guest for, I think, the next 6 or 7 years. You know, I kept coming back doing guests. Criminal Minds was a different case. It was a choice that I wish I hadn't made in the first place. I never expected to be that violent. I thought it was going to be about very different kinds of crimes, white-collar crimes, Watergate, other kinds of situations. And it turned out to be incredibly misogynistic and violent and really disturbed me deeply. And I felt irresponsible that this was that I was participating in a world bedtime story of such horror and terror of the worst aspects of society, and so no amount of money in the world would have made me feel good. Mm-hmm. And life was short, and I wanted to make sure I didn't waste it.
You showed up a few years later, or maybe it was before Criminal Minds. I can't remember the sequence. On a show that I thought was delightful, and it didn't last long. It was on Showtime called Dead Like Me.
Yeah.
I loved that show. You were essentially not the devil, but you ran a bunch of people who went out and collected souls so that they would be protected just in their moment of passing from here to the next realm.
Yes. It was a wonderful show created by Brian Fuller. We had a wonderful time, but it went to TV heaven after 2 years. It was a pleasure doing it. We lived in Vancouver during that time. And all of these, by the way, Dead Like Me, Criminal Minds, Chicago Hope, Homeland, and everything I think else that I did in between were all done with CBS or the larger company, Les Moonves and Nina Tassler, who stayed close with me all through all those adventures and worked with me and understood my concerns and my needs during those times.
That speaks highly of Les Moonves, who doesn't strike me as somebody who would be like that.
No, he was extraordinary to me. He really understood my dilemma. And he let me go in both cases without any problem.
So now you show up in one of television's surprisingly most successful shows, even though it's on Showtime, a pay cable station,
also a CBS company.
Yes, Viacom owns it, and not everybody can see this, but it is killing in both the cable ratings and at the Emmys this year.
Yes.
Does the success of this show surprise you?
I tell you, when something's good, I'm not surprised that people come.
It's excellent.
I am so privileged to be a part of this. I am so humbled to be a part of this. Our writing team is one of the best that has ever existed. Our company of actors is simply glorious, led by Claire Danes, who is the gift to us all. And Damien's work is extraordinary. Everyone's work is extraordinary. Our crew is extraordinary. Living in Charlotte has been a blast. From the guy who puts the air in the tire to get the coffee to the chip in the camera, because there's no more film in the cameras. everyone, from the moment we started the pilot to the moment we started doing the first show of the first season, when no one had seen a single episode up to that point, knew that we were involved in something unique and special. And we were working 14, 16 hours a day, and nobody complained, because we all knew, no matter what part of the game you were in terms of there's a lot of areas on a film, you know, that everyone knew this was unique and doesn't come along every day. So down the road, when it was embraced by the world at large, that was incredibly fulfilling. And one never expects it. And trust me, don't ever take it for granted. Mm. You have no way of knowing. When we made The Princess Bride 25 years ago, it was a flop. Nobody came to the theater. And then all those years later, it became what it became. And so you'd never know.
You play Saul Berenson, who is the CIA's Middle East chief,
yes.
Division chief.
Suicide bomber almost blew up Vice President Wallen. Jesus, when? When Elizabeth Gaines shot. Remember him in the bunker with all cronies?
Remember, I was one of the cronies.
Someone had on a suicide vest. He made a tape.
And you are Claire Danes' on-again, off-again boss. She plays Carrie Matheson. And what's fascinating about this show is if those of us who liked 24, because it was about terrorism and it was quick and every minute there was a new cliffhanger, this has cliffhangers, but more importantly, it has questions. You never quite know what's what.
Yes.
Do you know what's what?
No, I asked the writers not to tell me. I want to be in the same position as the audience. I want to turn that page and find out, just like the audience finds out. Of course, I'm going to know 7 to 10 days before we film it because I have to learn my words. But I don't know what's going to happen in real life. Why should Saul Berenson know what's going to happen in his life? If you ask me the question, don't you need to know as an actor? Don't you need to know whether you're the bad guy or the good guy or this or that? My answer is no, I don't need to know. Because whether you're Hitler or Gandhi, you both believe that you're actions are going to make the world a better place. And so everyone thinks that what they do is for the greater good, unless you have a screw loose and a wire cut in your brain and walk into a theater in Aurora, Colorado and destroy humanity. And certainly you could say that about Hitler. You could say that about a lot of people. And what I think is so extraordinary about this piece, Homeland, is it asks people to ask questions that are rarely asked in life, let alone TV, which is who is responsible for the state of the world, for the state of humanity. Humankind right now, in my opinion, is broken, and we have to fix it. And one of the ways this show echoes the possibilities that exist in terms of fixing it is it asks us, can we listen to each other. We have lost the art of listening in our culture all around the world. I often use the image of a dinner table. This show is about family. It's about the family of a father-daughter with Saul and Carrie, with Brody and his daughter, the family of the CIA, the family of the United States, and the family of the world at large. We elect officials in our country to be the heads of the dinner table of the family. These officials at times in the United States of America are so polarized that they can't speak civilly to each other. These are the heads of our family, the heads examples of the world's family. And when they can't speak civilly to each other, what does it teach the children of the world? And what I think this show has the possibility of doing in an entertaining psychological thriller atmosphere is ask the question, can we learn to listen to each other and learn the lost empathy and compassion for another human being's differences, something foreign, which is often frightening to people, and listen to what is the possibilities that put us in this place we are all in all over the world in the first place. How did we get here? And who is responsible? Who are the bad guys and who are the good guys? And stop thinking that, you know, it's only them. It's all of us. There's no one-way conversation in this world.
I'm looking at you talk. You are so committed. You are passionate. And that is what makes you a good singer and a good actor, isn't it?
I tell you, I don't know. I love this life. I think, you know, you're here for 1 second. I have been so blessed with my children, my wife, work that I love, people that I love to work with. I care. I would love to see in my lifetime peace in the Middle East. I would love to see an environment repaired. I would love to see people at the heads of our government learn to speak civilly to each other once again. And I believe that can happen. I was just in Israel shooting the first 3 episodes of Homeland, and I went to a peace conference filled with young people. And these young people, after I walked all over the conflict in the West Bank and Hebron and Ramallah, were filled with optimism and hope. They believe that a solution to the end of this conflict can be found, whether it's a two-state solution or whatever. They know it's an unsustainable solution, but they believe, even under Netanyahu, that a solution can be found. And to be in a room of young 20, 30-something-year-olds who have that kind of optimism, who live in that world every minute, is incredibly inspiring.
And we'll leave it with that. And you said you have a couple of moments left in your life. We'll leave it with maybe the minute waltz here. Mandy Patinkin, Dress Casual, Sunday night at the Belk.
See you there.
I have less than 30 seconds, less than 30 seconds, less than 30, less than half a minute. I have less than 30 seconds, I have less than half a minute to complete this little minute waltz. Remember every note that's in the score wall, the sense of time and a worry. If I step, I stumble, or I'm in a bit of time to schmaltz. Oh, golly, gee, oh, I hate these halts. Take my apology for plunging madam, but you know I've got such little time to finish what I've started. So though it's a crime, I'll forge ahead, and after all, I know I'll never make Carnegie Hall. I'm quite resigned. Just let me win my bet, and I'll run with my money down to some big store, and there I'll buy a honey, the trophy for myself to put up on the shelf to show the world I've won. Oh, the second hand is rushing round the dial. No, I'd like to end this torture with a smile. Unless someone knows how to stop the clock, you're gonna see me cry before I've said goodbye. I've only 8 little measures to complete the song, but I'm afraid my little lungs will burst before too long. If only I could last the scale, I won't have failed to sing the little minute waltz.